Well, as Virginia voted on Tuesday for a new governor and elected officials, I began thinking about the different traditions of passing on leadership from one administration to the next. President Ronald Reagan is credited for starting a tradition in the White House of an outgoing president writing a note to an incoming president. Now, of course, he wasn't intending to start a tradition, so as the story goes, he wrote a note to incoming President George H.W. Bush on a notepad with a Thanksgiving graphic on it, so it had a turkey, and he wrote in hand, "Don't let the turkeys get you down," right? Inspiring words. 4 years later, President Bush wrote his own letter to Bill Clinton. "There will be tough times," he wrote, "made even more difficult by criticism you may not think is fair. I'm not a very good one to give advice, but just don't let the critics discourage you or push you off course." The full note is actually very beautiful. It's filled with dignity and class, and it ends with this very nice words of encouragement: "I'm rooting hard for you." Nice. Then the notes from Clinton to Bush, and Bush to Obama, and Obama to Trump are also filled with meaningful advice. Echoing his father, George W. Bush wrote, "The critics will rage. No matter what comes, you will be inspired by the character and compassion of the people you now lead. The sheer joy of doing what you believe is right is inexpressible," wrote Bill Clinton. Obama wrote, "We are just temporary occupants of this office. That makes us guardians of those democratic institutions and traditions that our forebears fought and bled for." These letters, they give us insight into the reflections and the passions of leaders who have shaped our nation. And this morning, our reading from Joshua comes at a similar point in Israel's history. Joshua is coming to the end of his administration. He had taken over leadership from Moses, who is known in the Bible as the greatest leader in Israel's history. Joshua had big shoes to fill and a big task to complete. His assignment was to help the Israelites settle the Promised Land, this region where modern Israel and Palestine are today, that had been promised to the ancestors going back to Abraham. The only problem was there were already tribes living on the land. Tribes known for their ruthlessness and military prowess, and this small configuration of families and farmers would have to enter the land. But God's faithfulness and Joshua's courage proved up to the task. And by the time he reaches the end of his career, Joshua is now leading a people who have settled enough territory to form the beginnings of a nation. So preparing to pass on that torch of leadership, senior Joshua reflects on the triumphs and failures of his administration. He offers advice to the people of how they can prosper and live in the land that they have settled. He begins back actually in chapter 23, reminding the Israelites of everything that God has done for them, from freeing them from slavery in Egypt, providing for them as they journeyed through the desert, and ultimately protecting them as they entered the land. Joshua testifies to God's abounding grace, unending mercy and unmerited love. And since God has been their Savior in the past, is continuing to provide for them in the present and will guide them in the future, then the only proper response, he says, is to revere the Lord, to serve God in sincerity and in faithfulness. The language here in Hebrew, it calls to mind teachings from both Moses and Jesus, to love the Lord your God with all your heart, mind, and soul. This is what Joshua is telling them to do. Be fully devoted to worshiping God and living lives that reflect the values of God. This whole lesson here, it's rooted in language of covenant, promises made to previous generations. And the covenant that it refers to is actually quite simple. Follow the ways of God. Practice lives that look like justice, love, and mercy. And you will live meaningful and life-giving lives here in the land of Canaan. But Joshua says the converse is also true as well. Practice love, justice, and mercy, and you will prosper. But if you do not, if you instead choose ways of injustice or violence, then you can lose the land just as the Canaanites did before you. The land is a gift from God. It's not a right, and it's certainly not a prize that the Israelites had won. Joshua tells them that all the good things that they've experienced are because of God's grace, not because of anything they've done on their own. As a former professor of mine put it, the land is a gift, but remaining in the land is a vocation. The covenant God calls them to is a way of life. They have to become the people God has called them to be. And this is an important point for us. In the Bible, the promised land and being the people of God, it's always rooted in covenant, not contract. Which may seem like I'm splitting hairs, but this actually is a significant difference in the Bible. We're all familiar with contracts in our lives. Right? We sign contracts for our cell phones, for our mortgages, for car payments. You sign a contract when you enroll your children in preschool. And the contract is very simple, the fundamental philosophy of it. I give you something, usually in our economy money, and then you give me something in return, like enough cell phone data to watch Netflix when I'm waiting in a grocery store line or something. Give me the loan amount I need for my house, keep my car working, all these kinds of things. And a contract is broken when one party fails to live up to their end of the bargain, right? I can't keep living in my house if I choose to suddenly stop paying mortgage, as much as I dislike paying my mortgage payments. But the bank feels differently. Now, in the Bible, a covenant is something different because it's not rooted in the exchange of goods, but in a relationship. It's less like a business relationship between a lender and a homeowner and more like a relationship between two partners in marriage. I mean, think about it. When two people love each other and it leads to marriage, we have a whole wedding ceremony, and the high point of the ceremony is us exchanging vows right before you share a kiss. Maybe you remember these promises for those of you who got married, right? For better, for worse, for richer, for poorer, in sickness and in health, till death do us part. If you're married and you don't remember those vows as I went through it, see me after class, right? There's some things we may need to talk about outside of this sermon. Wedding vows are filled with the language of covenant. Marriage depends on much more than the mechanical fulfillment of legal stipulations. Right? Imagine how crazy it would be If one day after work I come home and I tell my wife, Allison, look, today I didn't lie or cheat on you, so I have fulfilled my vow as a husband. I'm going to check the box of loving you today. I'll be on Facebook if you need anything. That's a great way for something to get thrown across the living room at me, right? I would be in big trouble because our relationship is about much more than ticking off some boxes. A healthy marriage needs multiple expressions of love that can't be written down in some kind of contract. Now, it's true that there are ways that we can express our love to someone else, right? By spending time together, supporting someone when they're experiencing grief, celebrating with them in good times. I cook Allison delicious steaks. Food is a love language for us, right? So that's one thing that I do. If you were to think about your marriage or a close friendship, right, there's probably something that you do for them that demonstrates it's an expression of your love. Take a moment, right where you are. Think of one thing that you do for someone that you love that means the world to them. It may not matter to someone else, right? Someone may not love getting every book that you buy, but for this person, they love it, right? What's that one thing? Here's extra credit for this week, and it's extra credit because it has nothing to do with where the sermon is going, but do that one thing for that person that you love, for that best friend or that partner, okay? Add some more love into this world. Pastor's orders, right? I'll write you a note after. But either way, you can't reduce our relationships down to what I do for someone and what they do for me. And in the same way, in relationships that matter, we all of a sudden don't break up because someone forgot to take the trash out or move bags from one place or the other. Right? That would be crazy. Actually, most of our relationships are strengthened by those times that test us and healing afterwards. And the same is true for our relationship with God. It's not a contract here. Joshua is not concerned that the people are going to break a contract with God and all of a sudden they're going to get evicted from their home. Right? He's reminding them that they have a covenantal relationship with God that requires constant attention, constant devotion. If it's going to grow and be deepened, if it's going to matter in their lives. It's the reason why Joshua brings up this topic of worshiping other gods. He says in verse 14, "Now therefore revere the Lord and serve him in sincerity and faithfulness. Put away the gods of your ancestors served beyond the river and in Egypt and serve the Lord." Now, this doesn't always strike us in the same way because most of us, I would assume, did not spend our childhood in the ancient Near East. But if you were growing up in the ancient Near East, you would have grown up in a community that believed there were many gods that could be served at any given time based upon what you needed. So let's say that you are in need of a new car, then you find the deity of automobiles and you make sacrifices and then you get a new car, right? And it's a contractual relationship. I make a sacrifice, then deity gives me a new car. That automobile god is not very upset if I need to go pray to the mortgage god, right? We can do all these at the same time. But for Joshua, he's reminding them that the God of Israel is a very different kind of God. This God is not looking for an open relationship, but something that is monogamous, right? Exclusive. One, because this God is able to provide for everything that you need, but two, this God is looking for a relationship that is much deeper than something casually exchanging goods. God asks that we fully engage in a life of faith and reflect the love of God in every aspect of our lives. reverence and obedience, they pop up in this text, not as legal demands, but because they are outward expressions of our gratitude for God's goodness to us. We share love with other people because we first have experienced God's love in our lives. We help someone else because we believe we've experienced God's help in our life. Many people today in the church are wary of using these words of covenant and obedience, right? Some of you might have got a little uncomfortable at this passage, right? Especially when it got to those warnings at the end. It said, I don't like that. Could we have read Nice Jesus, right? But here, the covenant, it's not about rigid legalism or some kind of guilt-ridden faith where we're constantly trying to avoid a lightning bolt coming down from heaven. A covenant in the Bible, it's about those practices that lead to a healthy spiritual life. The ways in which we can engage deeper with God and with others in ways that are meaningful and life-giving. Following the teachings of the Bible, it's just an outward expression of something that's happened inwardly. Our own church, we have a covenant. And our covenant, it's not about the rigid rules about determining who can and can't be a member. It's about talking about the ways in which we feel we practice our faith in ways that help us on our spiritual journeys. Ways that I might just boil down for you rather than reading the covenant for you today. There are four areas to it. It's about worship, about learning, serving, and giving. Worship, learn, serve, and give. We most often think about worship as what we're doing right now, right, in corporate spaces. But as a church, we think that worship happens any time you are reflecting on and celebrating who God is to you and for you. Worship can be a time to recharge your spirit. It can be a time to discover inspiration. Worship can happen together in this space. It can happen on a hike at this time of year in Northern Virginia when you get to a peak and you just look out at a sea of gold and red and orange. Get struck by transcendent beauty. Worship is first and foremost just a place for you to listen to the voice of God, to experience God's presence at work. We learn in Bible studies, workshops, and retreats, not because we're forced to or because we're all competing for a gold star and who has the best attendance, but because we believe that there's never a point that we arrive at in our lives, no matter how old we are, that we have suddenly figured out all of life and God and the universe and achieved enlightenment and said, I'm done now. I will sit. No matter what age you are, we're always trying to grow, always trying to discover, to pursue our curiosities and our imaginations. And the small groups and different things we do as a church are just ways to feed your imagination. Part of a covenant is not just kind of this individualized journey where we worship on our own, we study on our own. We learn faith by doing. That's why volunteering, why service is so important. To connect what we believe about God intellectually with our hands and our feet, with the way we live our lives. Sure, there are worship services, sermons that I've experienced in my life that stick out to me as formative, but 9 times out of 10, if I'm going to tell you of a meaningful moment I had in ministry, it's volunteering with others. Or having a volunteer make a difference in my life as a kid growing up, or learning from someone. We learn
worship, we serve, and we give. Giving is a part of our spiritual lives as well. Not because we have to, not because I'll be in the foyer today running through the offering envelopes and seeing what you gave, right? But we give as a way of saying that everything that I have, all the blessings that I have in my life, they are a gift from God, and I want to use those gifts in meaningful ways to help others. That's what's at the heart of this passage today. Because I would imagine that most of you aren't too concerned that you are somehow worshiping other gods, right? If we polled the audience, I don't think anyone here has sacrificed on the altar of Baal or Asherah any time recently. Again, another point, if you have done that, see me afterwards. I have some concerns. Very few of us are tempted to be worshiping other gods like that. But all of us are tempted to worship busy calendars, hectic schedules, particularly as the holidays and year-end projects begin to pile up. We can spend less time in reflection, less time with the relationships that matter most to us. We can all too often spend more time worshiping our emails and our Facebooks and our Netflix, and maybe I'm just preaching to myself right now, but we can spend all these places here instead of closing it down and going getting coffee with somebody, doing that one thing you thought of earlier in the sermon, taking a walk, reading a good book. There are many different ways that we devote time elsewhere and not to the places where we really find meaning, where we really find joy, where we discover hope for our lives. And so today, and as you go from here in this week, I want you to think about these four areas. If I have kind of boiled down all of the covenant of the Bible, those areas of worship, of learning, of service, and giving. What's life-giving for you right now? Where are you finding joy? What's feeding your soul? And then what are those places that you want to grow in that maybe you're not really feeling a deep connection with God in this point in your life? We'd love to help you find that deeper connection. Because that's ultimately what this is all about. When Jesus was asked, what is the purpose of faith? What's the goal of the Christian life? He said that you might discover life and life to the full. That in connecting with God, in experiencing God's love, and in sharing it with others, you might discover real joy in life. Reason to wake up in the morning. All of this here, everything we preach about, ultimately, that's what it's about. You don't need any more stuff to do. But all of us are craving those spaces in our lives for meaning, for love, and for hope. And Joshua reminds us that we won't experience that in our lives by accident or through wishful thinking. But it will require intentionality, require devotion, require an obedience to those practices that enrich us. So, my friends, choose this day what you will do. I pray you choose those practices that feed your soul, that connect you with God, that connect you with others, that lead you to do those things that change the world. Perhaps in that way, we can become the people of God that we've been called to be, that we might live and prosper in love and joy, because that's truly our promised land. I leave you with that hope and faith today. Amen.